Stanley Kubrick would be very fastidious in how much he would detail he would put into it.
Definitely.
And how long he'd spend on doing it. And of course, originally he tried to use real primates for the filming of the original scene. He enlisted the help of what's her name, Mary Chipperfield. He used to train primates because the idea was he was going to have real monkeys doing it, and they weren't cooperating very well originally, so he enlisted her help. And
this is going to be, you're making this shit up, aren't you?
No.
Welcome to the first episode of the Film and Companion Pieces series. I'm Rich.
And I'm Adam. Today we're going to be talking about 2001 A Space Odyssey and the original Planet of the Apes.
We've had a bit of a hiatus, haven't we? You've been busy, I've been busy.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while, but you've been on a fair few trips though. I know you've just come back from London as well.
Yeah, I was down London last weekend and I took the opportunity to go and see a few filming locations, a few places where James Bond had been filmed, etc. Got a few good photographs. And there's a couple there that you didn't quite get, did you? You weren't sure which
one
was from.
No, no. So I recognised there was a cafe or a bar or something, wasn't there, that you showed me? That I recognised more.
I think,
but the grassy knoll I didn't.
Yeah, well, maybe if we put them on your Instagram, the film and podcast Instagram.
Yeah, or the Facebook group.
Yeah,
I'm sure people will get it straight away.
I'm sure they will, yeah. I'm sure they will.
You're not going to give it away, are you? You're not even going to tell me.
No, I'm not going to tell you.
So, James Bond Museum as well, or James Bond exhibit that you saw.
Yeah, actually, I went to London to see the Bond in Motion exhibition, which is in one of the cinema and film museums in central London, quite easy to get to. And they've got quite a big exhibition of basically a lot of James Bond cars. So, as you'd expect, a lot of Aston Martins, some of the special cars like the Lotus submarine car.
You didn't
press
any buttons, did you, or anything?
I tried not to, no. I tried not to. And they've got some really good props. So they've got everything from some of James Bond's passports there and a lot of clothing that was actually used in the film. So, yeah, definitely well worth a look, for sure.
Fantastic. Yeah. What have I been up to?
Did you get your Jar Jar Binks costume dry cleaned yet?
Do you know what? It's unavoidable at the minute with Star Wars, because obviously with Disney Plus as well, and it's just Mandalorian this and Mandalorian that. And
are we in danger of being swamped by it too much, maybe?
I think that's been and gone. I think I don't want to dwell too much on Star Wars, but yeah, it's getting a little bit sick of seeing it, to be honest.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'd hear you say that.
I know. We were big fans. Well, I was as a kid, and I was up until only probably a few years ago, to be honest. But, yeah, it's always, I've said it a million times before, it's always been about Empire Strikes Back for me, though. That is a film that's seminal, and it holds up.
Yeah, definitely.
But, yeah, we don't want it to be a Star Wars ranty episode. We want to look at two really classy pieces of sci-fi.
When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
Delving into these films, there's a hell of a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, and a lot of a few famous actors that are in it. Obviously, Charlton Heston being of the time quite a famous actor.
Yeah,
he was in Planet of the Apes, and then there was quite a few other bits as well.
Hang on a minute, something happened with the mic. What are you?
Get your damn hands off me, you damn dirty ape!
Full of brilliant quotes, amazing lines. I mean, this is Apes in particular. I think is I'll come to this. I do think it is the most watchable out of the two.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put it on the table right there. It's a film that I can watch at any point. I think I can just put that film on and know that I can get through it and watch it.
Yeah, it reminds you of sort of a film they perhaps put on at 6 o'clock in the evening on a weekday when you come home from school, and you'd watch it and you'd just sit there and watch the whole thing, or a Saturday afternoon you'd sit and watch that. And yeah, as you say, it's you can pick it up, can't you, as you go along.
Definitely.
And then, of course, there's the sequels, the many sequels that they
We'll get to. Yeah. So, I mean, they are two films that, mainly by coincidence, by choosing these films, they're obviously made the same year in 1968. They both have apes in them, but 2001, obviously, it's mainly the prologue at the beginning.
Yeah, with the very early primates.
And that was, you know, a sequence which I think, still now when you watch it today, it really holds up. But it feels, the way Kubrick shot that, it feels like a really visceral nature documentary.
Yeah,
as though literally like people, you know, Attenborough and his crew have travelled back in time and they're there kind of, you know, just happen to have just caught these, you know, early man, you know, about to make the first kill. So it's a really, you know, poignant moment in history. And we'll come to that with what 2001 is trying to say and the narrative and everything. But I think also both of these films, whether you've got the cerebral approach of 2001 A Space Odyssey or the rather kind of B-movie, Twilight Zone-y feel of Planet of the Apes, they both deal with humanity and what happens to us all and what is going to potentially happen to us all.
Yeah, and in different ways.
Yeah, definitely.
They look at the future of the Earth as well, looking even further ahead.
Yes, and I think 2001 in particular, being such a seminal piece of work, even though I prefer Apes as a rewatch, there's no doubt about it, 2001 is a better film in terms of the way it's designed and the way it's put together. Pretty phenomenal. It still holds up now. You watch it in HD. Some people are probably fortunate enough to even see it in 4K as well. There's been recent screenings. It is astounding how that film holds up, and I do think it holds up because he's created it almost as a musical piece, you know, something which is layered and layered and layered, that when you return to it, there's always something else that you'll pick up on. You almost like grow into it. I mean, I know we were at school and there was a lad in our class, wasn't there, and he was like beyond his years, like the stuff he was into, and he was obsessed with Arthur C. Clarke, do you remember?
Yeah.
And he would be always reading the books in the library, and he was, you know, bless him, he was like one of these lads that would be set up for complete ridicule, and, you know, he was almost like cast out, wasn't he, for like being somebody who was so into something that was, you know, typical what we would call a nerd now, but I look back on that and think, Jesus, he was into stuff that it took me years to catch up on and appreciate. I know you read some of the books, though. You read 3001?
Yeah, many years ago I read 3001, and obviously it takes place quite far in the future. And there are the monoliths still covered in it. And you've got, as far as I remember, in the Earth has now got a big space station which orbits the Earth. It doesn't even orbit the Earth, it's attached to the Earth by huge towers that you go on up in, like a huge elevator. So it again, Arthur C. Clarke, it presents that view of the future and the possibilities of what the Earth will be like. And then I doubt we will have that in 3001, but who knows?
Yeah, but I think, it seemed that Clarke was aware and had this finger on the pulse, didn't he, in terms of what was happening within his time.
And
I think
it was to do with the Earth as we know it, wasn't it, whereas somebody like Isaac Asimov would often be about far off worlds that are maybe in a different galaxy that we're never going to be connected.
And the way the
with.
Cultures evolved within those far off worlds as well, the kind of mythology that built around that, the language, the encyclopedia, literally the encyclopedia in Foundation. But it's really interesting how, I think Asimov, if you were to kind of make those links, absolutely Asimov was an influence on Arthur C. Clarke, without a doubt. Almost a contemporary, but almost Clarke was somebody who sort of carried on the reins, I think, of his writing.
And if you look at the way that science fiction films were influenced by these films and then by the authors, probably a lot of science fiction films are based in another galaxy, another time in space, aren't they? They're completely...
Definitely.
The Earth is nothing to do with it, whereas some, like both these films that we're talking about, take place with Earth's future. And, of course, in Planet of the Apes, you don't know that it's the Earth till the very end.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, apologies for that.
Yeah, sorry, if you are listening to this episode, we are hoping you'll listen to it because you want to hear mainly our opinions and our outlook on this film, but they're both embedded in literature.
Yeah.
They're, one comes from more of a pulpy novel, the other one comes from hard sci-fi. Saying that, Arthur C. Clarke's original story was only a short story,
mm-hmm.
and I know that from obviously reading things about the film and watching the documentaries as well, that Kubrick wanted to make a film with Arthur C. Clarke and collaborate with him. And because of the nature of Kubrick, which we'll get to, how fastidious he was and thorough with the material he was looking at, he asked Arthur C. Clarke just send him a lot of the stories, shorts, novels, and he pored through them and literally cast aside which ones he wasn't interested in and focused on a short story called The Sentinel, which, yeah, it's pretty much the scene where they're on the moon mm-hmm. with the monolith.
Mm.
And most of that and the design, and especially, I would say, the design of the monolith and how minimal that design is very much a Kubrick trait, I would say. And I do think it's just as much Kubrick's vision, if not more, than Arthur C. Clarke. He's created the story, but the look of this film is coming from an auteur filmmaker.
Mm.
And I think this is where they're interesting films to compare, because they're where one film is very cold and clinical and just, you know, looks like a solid piece of design,
mm-hmm.
Which is hugely influential. The second one feels naturally more organic, and I think by the nature of the way that it's made, and you know, with Franklin J. Schaffner, who directed Planet of the Apes, he came from a TV background, and I think Planet of the Apes was only his second film, if I recall. The rest of it was just years of working on TV, so you can see how efficient he was at making that film. He was the right director for it. It had to be made very quickly. I think if you look at the history of Sanek and Brown, who produced Jaws, they were very much about, you know, trying to, they usually cast their eye on production very carefully. Mm-hmm. And if things started to go over, they would probably get a bit twitchy. And, you know, Planet of the Apes had its ups and downs during production, but I think if you didn't have Franklin J. Schaffner there as the director, it would have spiralled out of control. So it's when you use that as a contrast to Kubrick, you know the stories, if you're familiar with him, of, you know, 20, 30, 40, up to 80 takes on
and
a scene.
And the attention to detail and the methods that he used.
He literally drove people mad.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's all sorts of stories of Shelley Duvall, who never, ever recovered from working on The Shining. She had a nervous breakdown. You know, it's almost like he took the kind of view or throwaway comment that Hitchcock once made about actors becoming cattle.
Yeah.
And I think...
Disposable.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think Kubrick, he seemed to have that kind of funny, odd contradiction where when some people talk about him and say how warm he was, maybe off camera, but when he was on set, it's almost like...
Ruthlessness.
Absolutely, yeah. For that vision to get what he wanted and to create what he was creating, it was whatever the cost, really. The other thing I think is interesting about his two films as well, where you've got an auteur filmmaker working with predominantly TV actors, and then Planet of the Apes, you're having a TV director working with a movie star.
Yeah, Charlton Heston.
Yeah, and I think although his career was on the wane, Planet of the Apes is a film that really started to take him off in new directions, I think. I mean, he was obviously well-known for biblical epics.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he dabbled in noir and he did, you know, westerns, The Big Country, fantastic. But this really, I think, started to create that slew of films such as Soylent Green would be a good one. Mm-hmm. Is it the Gemini Man, the I Am Legend adaptation? One of the three adaptations of Richard Matheson's novel.
But this is probably alongside Ben-Hur, his most iconic film that most people remember him.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, yeah, they are very different filmmakers. But, yeah, I think the fact that they're both based on a piece of literature, they've got a source material already in place. There's a story there where one is actually a novel. Pierre Boulle, who wrote the original Planet of the Apes novel, also wrote, do you know what other book he wrote? And this is something I did not realise until reading the recent J.W. Rinsler book, which I would recommend people hunt down, which is his Making of Planet of the Apes book, which is absolutely fantastic. It's a real thorough look at the production of the film. But yeah, I found out when I was reading that he also wrote the original novel of The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Really?
Yeah, so that yeah, that's Pierre Boulle. So yeah. That book was originally published in the early 50s. And then obviously David Lean, if I recall, made Bridge on the River Kwai. So another classic.
Mm.
So all about, again, you know, you could kind of make parallels to that even, and the kind of hardships of man, and, you know, how, you know, even like different factions of humanity turn against each other, war, the aftermath of war, prison life, torture. You know, it's there. It's interesting. And I think Boulle, although he, obviously it was optioned, he wasn't quite happy with the way the film was developing and progressing.
Mm-hmm.
I think his ideas didn't really translate to film in the way that they hoped it would. But I think because of the decisions they made to take the apes away from something that was a technological society instead, and I think even up until the point where Rod Serling was involved, he was, you know, he was on board with that. And I think he even sort of took it as far as the technological side. And then they decided to change tack with that. So once they got other writers involved, it started to evolve into something which became a little bit more mythological, I guess. It's almost like built out of a lost civilization, but it's reverted back slightly.
Yeah, so it's reverted back to basics, to living in the wild, and then gradually building. I mean, it's basically mud huts.
Yeah, it looked like building back up again.
Yeah,
yeah, taking what they would think how an ape would interpret the world and create their own language and their symbolism. So, some of the big questions then, when we look at these two films, similarities then. So we spoke about the fact that they were made the same year, they both involve apes, and it's about humanity. But what else is there? Is there anything else there that we think that is similar about the films?
Well, both of them involve a space mission, don't they? To another planet. So in 2001, it's an unknown mission. The crew don't really know, do they?
Until
they get there, what the secret mission is. Whereas in Planet of the Apes, it's more of an exploration mission, isn't it? There's four astronauts, and they're to go and find this planet that they're aiming for. And I think the idea is to repopulate it, isn't it? Now there's a female astronaut there. And when they arrive at the planet, they realise that when they come out of hibernation, she's died in hibernation. And Charlton Heston's character, Taylor, mentions later on in his sort of... He's got like a... What do you call it? Over dialogue. That she was basically going to be like the mother, wasn't she?
Yeah, the Eve, if you like.
Yeah, yeah, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, I know we spoke about this briefly, and in today's world, and if you were to remake, not that it hasn't been remade, but if you were to have released that film now today, that people wouldn't swallow that at all.
It's almost the fact that there would be a question.
Well, absolutely.
This is
one woman shared amongst three men. That's what it's almost saying, isn't it?
But you could almost imagine that Taylor would probably fight the other two.
He'd be the alpha.
In the other films, so in the other Planet of the Apes films, there's a bit in Beneath the Planet of the Apes at the beginning when the two friendly chimpanzees played by...
Well, Roddy McDowell is in the original one, but he wasn't...
He wasn't in Beneath. Yeah. He's in it, but his character...
He was scheduling...
Cornelius, basically. Cornelius and Zira. They have a little bit of a disagreement. And anyway, there's a bit where Dr. Zeus comes in, the chimpanzee, and they have to make out that they've had an argument because they're trying to hide the new astronaut, Brent, that's just arrived. And so Zira sits down with a rag on her face, and the orangutan comes in. He says, "What's happened?" And she says, "Oh, Cornelius hit me because I was insolent." And he went, "Oh, okay, I don't blame him." But
yeah,
so things like that, yeah. which you'd say, "Oh, they probably won't do that." And,
although it's almost like they get away with it because they're hidden behind the masks of apes. They're saying that because they're animals, and that because they're not quite as civilised as humanity.
And actually, I remember going to Twycross Zoo many years ago and seeing in the...
What, and you watched a man and a woman hitting each other?
There was a female ape being
apes.
Hit by a... What did you think? It was a real...
No, yeah. Joking.
There was a female ape being hit by the male ape.
Right.
And it was probably...
So the mannerisms, yeah, and the
yeah,
kind of...
So that's perhaps where they got that
the
idea
instinct,
from.
If you like.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it is. It's you know, at the end of the day, human beings are pack animals, and on our base animalistic instinct, the alpha male is going to act a certain way towards other males and females within their group.
Yeah,
it's like the intolerance of an animal, isn't it? You know, that they don't. That's what they don't understand. That's just the way it is.
In the apes films, there's the ongoing theme of the humanity. So in the Planet of the Apes films, the chimpanzees, who are more the scientists, they are the humane ones. The gorillas are the
brute force,
the ones that want to fight. But then there's a bit in one of the sequels, which they're kind of prequels really, but the films that came after the original, which is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, where the sort of leader of the security that controls all the ape slaves at that time says, basically, when we look at you and we hate you, as in the apes, we do it because we see the dark side of ourselves, because we're evolved from you. So there's that message about, you know, are we evolved from the apes, and do we take on their characteristics, and then in the future, will it go back the other way?
It's funny, because the whole, with Planet of the Apes, and I guess this is something where it differs a lot from 2001, is how on the nose it uses the analogy of civil rights, and in the first film in particular, where it inverts the fact that the white man is the minority.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, what we would have seen as the inferior race, if you like, rise up, and they are now, you know, the most civilized beings on the planet.
Yeah.
And when something comes back from that to remind them potentially of a past that they've wanted to forget, that's what then starts making it a really interesting film. And I know it's another thing we've kind of alluded to and spoke about, is the fact that when you watch Planet of the Apes as a child, and you remember those moments that are so iconic, and you remember the ending as well, and we'll get to the twist eventually, but you do think that if that film was released now and it was produced in that way, even with the twist ending, that the way it's designed right from the offset, and pretty much, you know, 15 minutes into it when they crash land, is that most people would figure out that, well, it must be Earth. It looks like Earth. It's not alien enough. Because of budget and because the way it's designed.
And the design of the... Obviously, there's horses there.
Yeah.
Aren't there?
But does that detract from the film? Even if you're watching the film and you know immediately, and you figure out that, or you believe that he is on Earth anyway, but in the future, it's still a really well-made film. And yes, the twist adds to it. Of course it does. But after that, once the twist is revealed, these films are cemented. They become what they are. It's no longer a sci-fi film with a neat twist to it. And you can take the film and you can hold it on its own, or you can continue to watch the rest of them in the franchise and see what happens from there.
Yeah, I think it is worth watching the rest of them. I've recently rewatched all of these, all the original series of five films that I've got, and yeah, they're watchable. I think you weren't too keen, were you, on the later ones where it goes back to Earth?
Well, no, so, I do. The one I'm never keen on watching, and I've always had a problem with it, is Beneath the Planet of the Apes,
which is the first sequel.
Yeah, and I can, as an adult, I can appreciate them going in such a brave direction and trying something radically different. And I think it was too bleak for me. I was so excited to see Beneath as a kid, realising there was a sequel, because I didn't even know there was sequels. Yeah. I was too young.
Yeah.
And once I then finally saw it, I was like, geez, this is like, you know, it's relentless almost. It's actually pretty grim as well. You know, it almost plays like a horror movie. I would say the most cult film out of the series. And then Escape from Planet of the Apes is just a little bit more upbeat, and it, that kind of role reversal of the apes coming back. And in fact, I think I've got more affinity with apes because that's the first sequel I watched thinking it was the sequel.
Yeah.
I didn't realise there was one in between. And I always...
You mean you watched
Escape? Yeah, I missed it because I was young, yeah, thinking, all right, so there's another apes film, but this is a bit strange. They're on Earth.
You could almost watch Escape from Planet of the Apes without watching...
Or you could start with Escape.
Yeah.
It wouldn't matter because of the fact that it is a prequel. Yeah, it's this looped prequel, if you like. And yeah, I just think it's a really watchable film. And I think what makes Escape as well is, again, Roddy McDowall being back. And I'd like to talk a bit about the actors anyway, because, I mean, Charlton Heston and Roddy McDowall in particular. I think Heston obviously had the movie star status, and Roddy McDowall had the pedigree and the history with Hollywood from right back from being a child actor.
Child actor, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, if you've ever seen, you know, How Green Is Our Valley, the Welsh film, which I think is John Ford. That's good. That's a good film. I've just seen that recently, actually, for the first time. And then there's Lassie as well. He was in. I remember seeing Lassie.
One of the old
early
films.
Four. Yeah. And I think Elizabeth Taylor is in that with him.
Yeah.
I know they did a few films together. So yeah, he was somebody that obviously settled in America very young, made a career as a child actor, and then gravitated towards, you know, which was quite rare back then. He grew into roles, and I think Roddy McDowall is one of those staple actors, again, from my childhood. One of the first actors I really remember because of, I don't know, he just had this really human quality about him. You know, really warming, inviting, friendly face. He was always cast well. The Poseidon Adventure, I always remember him in the Poseidon Adventure as well. Fright Night, he's brilliant in Fright Night. And yeah, Roddy McDowall, I thought, was brilliant. And he's in one of my favourite rom-coms as well, Overboard, of Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. Have you seen that? Yeah, he has a minor part in it. He doesn't really do or say much, but when he says what he needs to say, it's the line that is the most important line in the film. So yeah, he's great. And I think in contrast to Heston, where you had Roddy McDowall, who was somebody who became quite almost like an obsessive about Hollywood in terms of collecting memorabilia and film, and he would have his own warehouses full of props and film, and yeah, really interesting guy. Apparently, if people wanted anything, they would call up Roddy McDowall, and he'd know everything about things in films, because he'd say, I've got the original canister of that silent movie, or I've got these props from this film. Yeah. So he was a
fan as well.
A fan as much as anybody. He was almost like what Mark Hamill is today, or Bruce Campbell or something like that.
You could argue that, like, Mark Hamill now will be forever remembered as Luke Skywalker. Mm. Roddy McDowall, rightly or wrongly, will be forever remembered as Cornelius, and later on as Caesar in the later films.
Yeah, I would say so. And I think there's a similarity. There's definitely a similarity. A kind of they're fans first of film.
Mm.
They love film, or they live the geek culture, if you like.
Yeah.
Whereas Heston was a fairly serious movie star.
I got the impression that after this film, he probably went on to the next project, and that's why.
Well, he was tied into it.
In Beneath, he only has a very brief appearance
because
he
had to honour his contract.
Yeah, to be in it.
Yeah, he was contracted for one film. He was very reluctant to do it. I think it comes across as well the way he bookends Beneath, doesn't he? He starts in it and then he ends.
And he's very, very late on in the end, and almost the other astronaut, Brent. He's almost in the mould of Taylor, isn't he? Looks very similar. And I think that's why they picked him as well. Apparently they picked him because he looked similar.
Well, he was a great physical actor. Yeah. I think Heston is one of those movie stars that is... If you were studying the action hero and the action roles, Heston would absolutely be in that lineage of real, stoic, strong characters. Yeah. If you're looking at, like, Robert Mitchum, Kurt Douglas... Chuck Heston, and then you kind of then go in towards Clint Eastwood, who starts to reinvent the hero, creates the anti-hero, and then you finally get the natural progressors of that, Schwarzenegger and Stallone, and now it's all superheroes. Any theatre actor or a well-respected actor can be the hero now, with a bit of CGI and some padding in their costume. But that's what it's about, it's gravitating more towards that, whereas in the day... It was very much the movie star. And I know, obviously, we're not going to be able to skirt around this, but later on in life, and in fact, shortly after this film, Charlton Heston's political views and his path came into question a lot. And I think when you read the Making of the Planet of the Apes book, it's so well written and, you know, rightfully so, they don't dwell on any of that. But I think when you read about Charlton Heston and you watch the infamous scene in Bowling for Columbine where,
Michael Moore goes and confronts him, doesn't he?
You'll prize my gun from my cold dead hands and all this. And it's chilling to watch after a young child's been killed. Yeah. And for years and years, his views had been percolating and had shifted, and... They reckon it was to do with, because he was very good friends with Martin Luther King, and this is when his political views were very different. And when Martin Luther King was assassinated, Charlton Heston's mindset and his views on things completely changed, and that's when he started to lean more towards the NRA and have guns.
That's
should
interesting because at the end of Beneath the Planet of the Apes, they've obviously got a plan to, I think it's to stop the humans using the Doomsday Bomb.
That's right.
And then they're made to fight each other by the humans there that are telepathic. Brent and Taylor fight each other, and then anyway, when the apes invade the underground base, then Nova gets killed, and as soon as that happens, he just basically said, "Blow it, let's just kill the lot of them."
That's right.
Let's end the world.
It's almost like you could say that. What a kind of blunt symbol of Heston thinking, fuck it, one of my close friends who stood for something died and could have changed things and was assassinated by white men. His mindset then starts to go in a different direction. Yeah. And that's not condoning what he said or what he was doing. And do you know what? It's probably a hell of a lot more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to sort of like dwell on that too much. But he's a very different character. But it's that question, isn't it? Would you never watch Planet of the Apes because you see Charlton Heston as this opposing character who stands for guns and it being in every home and the risk of children again accidentally shooting each other would you ever watch a Kevin Spacey movie again? Do you know what I mean? Like it's separating the actor from the real person.
Yeah. But like you say, it is very downbeat beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Very.
At the end, basically, the world gets blown up by the Doomsday Bomb, and that's it, isn't it? That's it. That's the end of the world. There's no going back from that. But it's almost like, and again, the bit with Taylor's character arriving just at the end. It reminds me a bit of, can you remember from Blake 7, where the character Blake disappears at the end of Series 2, and he only reappears right at the end of Series 4 in that famous final episode. It's almost a bit like that, where she's been dragged back into it just to get closure.
See, Blake 7, I only ever watched a few episodes of, you know, and it's like a distant memory. I've never actually watched it all the way through, and I know, you know, how popular it was as well. Everybody used to watch it or even watch the reruns.
I used to watch the reruns. This is probably, I don't know, 15 years ago on UK Gold. I used to enjoy them. Of course, it's TV, isn't it? It's not big budget.
Well, it's classic British TV.
It's classic, and the way that they... it was often filmed in locations such as a seaside running around sand dunes or a quarry or something. And that's often where a lot of the locations for Planet of the Apes was like that.
Yeah,
walking
definitely.
Walking through Death Valley, walking down quarries with weirdly coloured rocks.
That's what I love about those sorts of films. And it's kind of, you know...
The location.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
Natural locations rather than a sound set. They use the natural locations.
Which Westerns used economically.
Yeah,
and I think
absolutely.
To use these, you know... environments for something that's apocalyptic, it works. And
I think it works if you've got good imagination, where people who are more maybe cynical might just look at, say, an old episode of a TV sci-fi and just think, oh, that just looks like a quarry.
Yeah.
Whereas if you've got a bit of imagination,
you think,
I can imagine that will be what another planet would be like, desolate.
Yeah, full of mutants, full of apes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and leading to that iconic ending. And, you know, I think if... This is where the films, on many levels, differ. But when you're looking at those two endings to these films, where one is such a classic twist, and, you know, yeah, we are going to spoil it. So at the end of Planet of the Apes, when Taylor has finally left Dr. Zaius from the dig, the archaeological dig, they found remains of human civilization, which is starting
to
hint.
Off, isn't it? Yeah, and Dr. Zaius says, Taylor says he's going to find out what happened in this world to make it as it was, and he says, "Be careful of the truth; you may not like what you find."
It's a great line, and he wanders off with Nova, and then it's slowly revealed, beautifully revealed through the set pieces. You see a hint, you see the spikes, the silhouettes. Cast against the sun, and then the different views from behind Taylor as he approaches, and then what's revealed.
The Statue of Liberty submerged in, it's pretty much half submerged in sand, isn't
it? It's such a classic image, and it's not an original image. A lot of these images were shown a lot in the 1950s. If you look at classic science fiction pulp magazines, the Statue of Liberty was shown time and time again in comic books, dilapidated and smashed up, because it was a true icon
of America, isn't it? Of
and
society.
Break it, you know, destroy it.
Yeah.
And it was so well done, you know, to then finally see an image like that on screen and deliver that punchline. This is absolutely, without a doubt, one of the most classic endings of any film.
Definitely.
I think... It's a stronger, more potent ending visually as 2001, but where this is really downbeat and saying that, you know, as Taylor says, you know, you blew it up.
Yeah.
You destroyed it all. And in 2001, it's more lifting in a way. It's saying that, you know, there is, you know, this chance for humanity to evolve into something else, which may become... hopefully something that's more positive, the Star Child, if you like, which is revealed at the end, where humanity has evolved and then almost kind of reborn again into the cosmos. And where do we go from there? You know, what does... God, it just blows your mind.
Yeah,
it's like, where is it going?
Endless possibilities, whereas with the End of Apes...
It's like a full stop.
Yeah, and again with Beneath... The Planet of the Apes, again, that's it, that's the end of the world, there's no going back from it. And there's just a little voiceover at the end that just says, you know, a small star in one of the solar systems with a small planet has just now disappeared, and that's the end of the film. Very, very downbeat. There's also a similar reveal moment in Beneath the Planet of the Apes when Brant is underneath the under the ground into the tunnels for the first time, and he realizes he's
with the underground system.
He's in an old New York subway, and that's the first time when he realizes. He says, "This is my home," and he realizes there's almost a reverse version of that on the remember Predators.
Yes.
At the start of Predators, when all the six people that have been selected and captured, they end up on in the jungle, and then again it's the other way around. They expect themselves to be on Earth, don't they? And then they look up, and there's a huge sort of valley which is nowhere on Earth, and then there's a sort of huge planet low in the sky. So they then realise they're definitely not on Earth.
Definitely. And, yeah, and that almost a little bit of a nod to H.G. Wells, this obsession with the Americans in particular. I mean, I'm noticing this as I'm writing my book, but there's a lot of stories, sci-fi, horror, that has this obsession with going underground, going into the catacombs, being lost in the caves, and part of humanity lost and buried, and they mutate and become something else, which represents either a lower class, or in this instance, in Beneath, they invert that and they become this kind of higher class of humanity, which is looking and worshipping not God, but they worship the bomb. Yeah, yeah. Almost a Doctor Strange, almost a Kubrickian
ideal. Good similarity. But actually, when they look at them, and again, there's a really good reveal moment in Beneath where the humans there, they suddenly realise that they're wearing masks and they're not actually as you think they are, and they're all sort of deformed mutants underneath. Watching that bit, it also reminded me of another old science fiction film, The Time Machine from H.G. Wells. And again, the two different paths that the humans have taken in the future world that he goes to. So there's the Eloi, which are the sort of docile cattle, if you like, that live on the surface, and then there's the Morlocks that are more the aggressive cannibalistic ones that live below the earth and basically eat the Eloi. You could make the comparisons with that.
Definitely.
And almost you could say society, will our society one day get to that point where it'll almost be split in two? There'll be the docile ones blindly working, and then maybe there'll be another type of person that will never work but is almost feeding off those that do work.
Absolutely. Classic tropes of sci-fi. Like I said, a lot of the some of the themes that are mined in these stories are some a little bit on the nose, some throwaway, some, as in 2001, very hard sci-fi. So where Planet of the Apes is about our closest relation evolving into something, 2001 becomes about our loss of humanity through technology, the evolution of AI alongside humanity, which is a really interesting thing.
Back then was science fiction, wasn't it? That a computer could think
in its very early stages.
Whereas now you can see it. Well, you've got adverts for Microsoft AI on TV now, and you've got smartphones, smart meters, smart cars, everything one day very soon be connected to the Internet of Things, as they call it.
Isn't it fascinating to watch 2001, though, and you see all of the devices and the vid screens and the things that look like iPads, and they're literally holding them and swiping through
almost
stuff.
Predicting what the future
really
will be.
Really close. There's many, many things in 2001 which are bang on and still feel as though they are modern. And I do think the cyclical nature of design has added to that as well. You know, people love their sort of Kubrick style furniture and interiors and minimalist design. You could say that the Apple products are very Kubrickian. There's a definitely an aesthetic there that's been adopted straight from 2001: A Space Odyssey. The white, the black, the sparseness of color, and how the shapes and the framing. Kubrick's framing is second to none. That idea of something which is very locked and parallel to everything, and the way the arcs and the shapes are very symmetrical in the shots.
Oh, yeah.
Are just, they are designed to the nth degree. They're unbelievably done.
Like the barrack room scenes in Full Metal Jacket,
yeah,
for example.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, he always uses that shot, and it's time and time again you see it, but the whole looking down at the cat, you know, up and into the camera lens through the eyes. And there's a really interesting image actually I've seen online where they crop parts of Malcolm McDowell's face from Clockwork Orange with the face of the soldier that kills himself in Full Metal Jacket to The Shining, and literally slot them together perfectly.
And that's how
accurate his framing was, even just in a character looking at the camera. So, yeah, you can definitely see them parallels. But his colours, yeah, his use of lighting, the cinematography, unbelievable.
And it's been obviously not mimicked, but it's influenced a lot of other films. We're talking about films obviously like Alien and Aliens,
yeah,
the way that the look of the spaceship, the sort of weathered effect.
Well, this
whereas
is it.
Up until then,
that's where it's born.
A lot of the TV sci-fi leading up to that is very shiny and kitsch, isn't it? Almost the design.
Unrealistic.
The spaceships are very shiny and glossy, whereas the spaceship in 2001 is very matte and weathered, isn't it?
So Kubrick's process of making the film, as you would imagine, is he's going to research that a lot. But his idea was to send his crew of production designers and Arthur C. Clarke around NASA. So they visited NASA and they spent a long time there. And then they had advisors from NASA helping to design the sets and the spaceships. So the used universe feel was born directly out of real life space.
Where
now you think, you know, when it was being made, which would be 67, it's 2 years before landing on the moon, but it's that lead up to it. So these films, both of them, and I would say 2001 makes a bigger impact, but it comes at a time where people are ready for it. I mean, obviously it's kind of during still, you know, the despondency with Vietnam War, but there's kind of this enlightenment to watching 2001. It's almost like an experience where soldiers would come back and just trip out on the end scene, or you know. But the ships, the used universe feel, that's where it begins, I think. And even when you look at 2001 A Space Odyssey, it predates Star Wars by, what's that, 8-9 years?
Yeah.
And it still looks amazing. So you wouldn't have Star Wars or Alien or anything like that if it wasn't for the way that 2001 was constructed.
And the ideas of the commercial space travel, isn't it? And the opening, one of the opening scenes where Pan Am spaceship. And of course now you've got Virgin Galactic and the other ones that are starting to. So they obviously,
and the anti-gravity scenes of them going around the, you know, when they're exit, when he's running. I think the film,
the way they filmed that was amazing. Yeah.
It really, I mean, the opening scene, I love the prologue, but I think the film really kicks into gear as soon as the Jupiter mission starts. You just see the way those astronauts function on that ship, and it's so realistic. The music, and that music that they use in the Jupiter mission, it's exactly the same as the Alien Sulaco track, isn't it?
It's very similar. I think it's very similar, yeah. And James Horner,
he must have lifted that.
There's some sections of James Horner's music in, for example, Clear and Present Danger that is very similar. It's the sort of behind the scenes.
He has a signature that he's kind of lifted there.
Yeah, so obviously influenced by
But you
that.
Can't not talk about 2001 without talking about the music, because it is literally like watching something orchestrated. Like the film is orchestrated visually as much as it is
that,
the sound.
The opening prologue when the primates, there's that scene where one of them throws the bone and it goes through the air, and then that immediately zips forward however many thousands of years and it becomes a spaceship.
Yeah.
That's one of the,
what a great edit.
That's one of the most spectacular parts of it.
And
so I suppose another similarity is, or difference, you could talk about the timeline. So Planet of the Apes, begins in, I think it's about 39-50 something, when Taylor originally goes to the, ends up at the planet, and then they obviously come back to Earth in about 1970. That's when the apes escape, when it gets blown up. They come back to 1970, and then Conquest of the Planet of the Apes jumps forward to 1991, and that's when the apes have been made into pets and servants. Mm. There's a lot more of them. They've evolved quite.
It's
quite
where
a
it
bit.
Doesn't quite work. It's, I mean, that's why the prequel reboot remakes are. I mean, they're my favourite trilogy of all time. I've said it a million times before, but the recent trilogy of Planet Apes films are phenomenal. And what they do very, very well is they remain ape-like just enough. They evolve just enough that's believable. But with these, they almost jump forward. And suddenly, as soon as Caesar's born, he's suddenly more human.
And
so what makes that?
And there's lots more that are just like him. Of course.
So how would that happen?
It would have been difficult to.
You can imagine Caesar being like that because of his parents.
Yeah.
But the other apes wouldn't have been. They'd have just been like normal apes. So it didn't. That you really have to ignore when you're watching the sequel.
Yeah, it almost needs to have jumped forward more than 20 years. But the story behind why the apes became servants and slaves is that there was a plague, and again this is linked to the fact that when Zira and Cornelius and Milo, he gets killed by a gorilla when they first arrive. They brought back a plague from outer space which kills all the cats and dogs, and that's the reason why humans then take on apes to be household pets. And then from being pets they then become servants and they train them. Although in the original story, I suppose the original timeline if you like, in the future, all Zira and Cornelius know is that there was a plague that killed all the cats and dogs. So it's almost like it's the the infinity. They go back in time to create that which they knew about.
Yeah.
Whereas you could argue if they didn't go back in time in the spaceship to escape the planet being blown up, then that future never would have happened.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting little link there.
Yeah, it is. I mean, they don't really sort of dwell on the whole time travel angle much at all with the Apes films. It just is a device that happens to kind of reboot it all, and then.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of hinted at from there,
and it's convenient that the three apes that escape from the planet as it's being blown up and beneath the Planet of the Apes, they happen to have resurrected the ship that sank in the lake at the beginning, and Dr. Milo, who's the sort of genius, he manages to work out how to fly it. It is quite convenient, isn't it? But it's part of the story, so it's part of it.
Yeah, it's well done. I think Planet of the Apes, the original, is, like we said before, it's a very economical film. I think Schaffner, when you look at, I mean, he didn't make a lot of films, only about 11 films on his credits, but when you go through and you recognise those films that you've seen that are really solid, really efficient. The boys are from Brazil.
Brazil, yeah.
I mean, I've spoken about that film quite a lot, but again, that's a really early thriller I remember watching very, very young, and it having quite an impact on me. I mean, the end scene is terrifying.
Yeah.
It's really violent, horrific.
Yeah.
But brilliant, the concept of it. And it seems that a lot of his films, especially Papillon as well, that, again, it's imprisonment, it's, you know, pattern, you know, war. And he's following very, very similar themes in a lot of his films, I think. I'm pretty sure Patton was like an Oscar-winning film, wasn't it, if I recall?
Is it George C.
Scott? He got an Oscar for that, I'm pretty sure he did. So, he's done memorable films. He's just not done as many. Kubrick was somebody who every film he brought out was just made an impact.
And he would never make the same sort of film, did
never.
He didn't do war films, he didn't do westerns.
No.
He would do one of a certain type of film and make an, you know, absolute epic.
Yeah.
And then that was it. He'd say, I'm done with that genre, I'm moving on.
Which makes sense to me. That completely makes sense to me. If I was fortunate enough and skilled enough to become a filmmaker, and bearing in mind you are spending 3 years of your life putting these things together and, and directing them. I think by the time at 3 years out, you'd be thinking, well, in order to go through this again, I'd want to do something very different. I'd want to explore a different type of story, a different genre, a different location, environment, something that challenges my storytelling.
But you could argue that that was part of the reason why a lot of people didn't quite get his films, because he put so much into it and in some ways made it, some of it, like at the end of 2001, it's quite surreal, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And very ambiguous. Yeah. And a lot of people didn't get that, and that's almost like, that's not what they expect from a cinema film. They want to know what happens at the
end. That's right. No. But again, that's what makes 2001 such a beautiful experience, though. And I can imagine,
that it doesn't pander to the average popcorn eater
in the cinema
to say, oh, all right, we've got to have a typical ending.
Do you know what? I get it. If somebody turned around and said, I watched 2001, it was boring, I just didn't understand it. I get it, yeah. It's a very slow-paced film. You've got to be concentrating watching it. You've got to want to be immersed in it.
And you've got to watch it more than once.
You have got to watch it more than once. But I take umbrage to people shutting off immediately, but at least try and watch it. But I get it to do with the pace, but to say it's, you know, a boring film, or you cannot, you know, not see how well made and how crafted.
And especially back then, before they had all the CGI technology.
Well, amazing. This film is well over 50 years old. And if you're going to be, you know, if you're going to look at that and say, you know, it's a film that is, it just shoot it down and say it's boring, it still holds up visually. You know, it doesn't look dated.
Yeah. You've got to appreciate how old
phenomenal.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely
and
phenomenal.
And a lot of the techniques for filming were groundbreaking at the time. And also with Planet of the Apes, the prosthetics that they used for making the apes were brilliant.
Revolutionary.
The main characters, obviously, that they're linked to their facial ones. And again, as I said earlier, when I think of Roddy McDowall, I just think of him as the ape.
Just the expression and how you can still pick up on the smile and everything. Yeah. I mean, in the making of book that J.W. Rinsler wrote, it's great because it there's bits on where he turns up on set and it gets to the point where, can you imagine in like the baking heat or something like that as well? And Roddy McDowall was almost kind of going crazy, you know, because of the heat and passing out. And it was really hard shoot for anybody dressed in that, you know, woolen heavy costumes. Dangerous.
Yeah.
But just going back to 2001, in terms of obviously we've looked at the actors in Planet of the Apes and, you know, movie stars and pedigrees of actors. 2001... there's actors in there we recognise from TV and the odd film. I think Keir Dullea, who acts as the main astronaut, Dave, he was in the original Thin Red Line, if I recall, and is in a lot of TV stuff that we wouldn't have seen over in the UK. But yeah, it's a funny one to watch 2001 because you just always remember those actors for that film and you never really see them in anything else. It's very rare you've seen them in anything. And I do think that's probably where a lot of the budget was saved. They put everything into the look and the production of the film. But there's one actor in it in particular that I think, for some people, I think maybe it takes them out of the film. British people in particular who are used to him. Leonard Rossiter.
Yeah, in Rising Damp, you just think of the landlord.
It doesn't for me, because I didn't really gel with any of those comedies, and that I was too young anyway. And certain ones, is it Rising Damp where he's in
he's the landlord.
Yeah, it used to get on my nerves, you know, as a kid, and I couldn't watch it. I'd have to go and do something else. There's a lot of comedies I just never ever got into them. They grated with me. But yeah, he is, I'm pretty sure, one of those actors that I'm sure some people, British viewers, were watching 2001, that it would take them out of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's trying to be like a Frenchman in it or something, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's got
an accent. Because I had to look back on it and think, is it definitely him?
But he's in Barry Lyndon as well, so he's in quite a few Kubrick films. So it's funny how he's kind of obviously using the same actors. And Barry Lyndon is, again, bloody hell, work of art. I mean, that film was
visually
unbelievable.
But it didn't do too well, did it? A lot of people didn't quite get it, or it wasn't what they
were. Well, it was used a lot of it. Some of the scenes were filmed with natural candlelight, weren't they? Like the meal scenes, yeah, and everything, which were stunning to look at. And again, it does show off, you know, what an auteur he was. So yeah, I think they're like the main sort of points, really. They both break conventions, absolutely break convention, I think, as two seminal pieces of sci-fi that came out the same year. And I think
the production methods as well, and the, obviously, yeah, you mentioned, yeah, earlier, Stanley Kubrick would be very fastidious in how much detail he would put into it.
Definitely.
And how long he'd spend on doing it, and of course originally tried to use real primates for the filming of the original scene. He enlisted the help of what's her name, Mary Chipperfield, who used to train primates, because the idea was he was going to have real monkeys doing it, and they weren't cooperating very well originally, so he enlisted her help. And
this is going to be, you're making this shit up, aren't you?
No. So he was given, she told him that he had to be firm with them, and he was given basically a stick to hit them with if they didn't do it properly.
Is this true?
Yeah, so if he, while he was filming, if one of them wandered off set or something, she would instruct him to give them a light tap. So anyway, he tried it, and it worked. And anyway, it went on for several days. Obviously, filming was dragging on. And then he arrived on set one day, and they came to do some filming. And then one of these primates basically walked off set and started picking up some food. So he flew into a rage because, as you know, he was very...
It's just got to be a joke. You are joking.
He could get quite angry. So anyway, he starts beating this poor monkey with a big stick. It's sort of on the floor, and everyone's looking around nervously because obviously they don't want to question the director. And then all of a sudden, from the monkey comes a muffled cry of "Stop! Stop!" And everyone looks around, and then the assistant director rushes on and says, "Stanley, what are you doing?" And then the actor seems like it was an actor. So what would happen is they'd changed the crews over, and they were using actors play the monkeys, and Stanley Kubrick didn't realise. So this guy took his ape hat off and everything, his costume, and they said, "Why didn't you say anything earlier?" And he said, "Oh, well, because I thought that's what Stanley Kubrick was like. I've been told to expect him to be hard on us."
Oh my God, that's true. Is it? It's not, is it? I don't know what to believe with you.
You'll have to look it up to find out if it's true.
Listeners can look it up as well. Oh, my God. Some of your stories. I should have read up. I just should have done my research more to see if I'm actually being jackassed or
Well, that was
punked.
It was in that DVD you lent me. It was in that bit. The one about his life in film.
If only the listeners could see it. I'm literally trying to read you at the minute. Anyway, moving on. Listeners, see if you can prove it right or wrong. Normally there's a punchline.
No, there's no punchline.
Flipping heck.
Sharing some
lots
anecdotes.
Lots of writers involved. I mean, Michael Wilson, I think he came on after Rod Serling, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Twilight Zone influence is absolutely there. You can feel it. I think the ending, the twist, I'm pretty sure that came from Rod Serling. That is very much a Twilight Zone flip. Every episode would end like that, wouldn't
brilliant,
it?
Brilliant, yeah.
Amazing, the original one. They still hold up.
The one about the one with William Shatner. And
it's classic. And then that was redone in the Twilight Zone movie, wasn't it? Yeah, so good. There's just
And Tales of the Unexpected, which is sort of the British version.
Yeah, much
there was
later.
Some really good little twists.
Some of them were horrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really horrifying. So yeah, a lot of people, and then John T. Kelly came on towards the end just to kind of spice up the dialogue a little bit more. Get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape. I mean, when he finally cracks and his voice comes back, again, it's just moments like that. It's phenomenal, really. And Heston, like, sells it as well. It's like you needed someone of his gravitas, I think, in that role, because to be in the part and not talk for a big chunk of the film,
yeah,
And it's pretty gruesome as well. You know, when you get shot in the neck, I always remember watching that as a kid and it's like, whoa, you know, it really, really gets you.
And he comes across as very cynical, doesn't he, Taylor's character?
Yeah, definitely.
He's left Earth because he's basically fed up of it. And he's fed up of the world. So that's why he went into space.
Yeah, it is. It's believable enough. Definitely. So, are we ready to sum this up? Have we kind of spoke enough about the two films? Do you think is there anything more you want to add or share about either of them? Anything about?
I think there's more of a sort of a franchise, if you like, for Planet of the Apes, because there was obviously a lot of sequels at the time, plus the recent remakes.
Mm.
And then there was a TV series. Remember
that?
Of
course.
I used to watch that,
and I did watch the first episode actually not long ago, just to kind of prepare a little bit more for this, because I was very curious if it was as I remembered it, and it was very from a British viewer felt like a Sunday morning when they reran Land of the Giants and things like
the
that.
The sort of 1960s B movie type
they then,
series
in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, they regurgitated on Channel 4.
Yeah,
didn't they?
the 120,000 Leagues Under Sea, those kind of things. It has the same feel of the film as well, to a certain degree, which is not a bad thing. It seems familiar.
But 2001 still feels like it is a piece of literature. Planet of the Apes doesn't. It feels like it's a piece of cinema. Now, that's not to say 2001 is absolutely a piece of cinema. It's incredible.
Mm.
But it's because it's its hard sci-fi roots, it feels lyrical still. It feels as though there is ambiguity to it you can read into. And it's so deep and has so many layers in there. Yes, there's been a sequel, it's 2010, but it's not something you could merchandise or, you know, in the same way as you could with Planet of the Apes. Then, you know, we talk about the birth of the blockbuster with Jaws and then later Star Wars and the boom in merchandise, and people really latch onto that. But Planet of the Apes was doing it way before.
Oh,
you could get everything to do with Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
But it'd be interesting to see if that was more maybe sort of later on. Was it more to do with the TV series and that becoming popular?
I think it was more of a 70s, late 70s thing rather than at the time late 60s.
But, you know, a big deal. It's
and we're briefly going to mention the sequel to 2001, which was 2010.
Yes. Yeah, I like 2010. I prefer I know a lot of people prefer it to 2001, but I don't. Kubrick's is a masterpiece. It's pretty much untouchable. I know you could have easily done a film companion pieces episode with Christopher Nolan's Interstellar, really riffs off it. And I think Doug Trumbull does the effects for Interstellar as well, doesn't he? And he did Tree of Life.
Right.
And, you know, we've not mentioned Doug Trumbull, but the special effects that he created were incredible, really. You know, chemicals photographed and you know, and flipped, and you know, the starfield effects. It's unbelievable that, you know, space, the way it was all matted and put together was amazing. And Doug Trumbull, my God, you know, he's done some incredible work. So yeah, I think it is. It's one of them films that uses all the right people. Kubrick, obviously very good at bringing the best of the best together to create, you know, one of the most iconic pieces of cinema, let alone, you know, sci-fi.
Yeah, and as you say, it's iconic, isn't it? The music, the set pieces, the memorable bits that everyone can remember from it. So, yeah, it'll stand the test of time, won't it, 2001?
Absolutely. So, in summary then, what would you say is the better film out of the two?
As a sort of piece of art, as you put it, that can't be replicated, I would say that nobody will ever try and remake 2001.
No.
So in that respect, I would say that one, it would stand the test of time.
Objectively, it's quite easy to say it is obviously the better film. Yeah.
Yeah.
But personal favourite?
I think lately, because I've been re-watching all the Planet of the Apes films, I think I've enjoyed those more.
That's what it comes down to. You do enjoy Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
I think it feels like almost something slightly juvenile about it. It's like, you know, it's fairly kid-friendly. Maybe children of this generation would struggle with the original 68 version. But yeah, if you struggle with that, watch the latest trilogy.
But it does reflect the time, and at the time of the Cold War, it was the fear about nuclear Armageddon, and that message is in throughout, isn't it?
That's what it's all about, apocalyptic sci-fi, wasn't it, in the late 50s through the 60s, really. Yeah, a lot of that. So if we were to show this as a double bill, then, which one would you put on first if you screened this as a double bill?
Probably put 2001 on first, while you still sort of, you can concentrate.
Yeah,
you've got to be totally into it.
Good
whereas
idea,
if you
yeah.
watch two films, the second one has to be a bit more easy to watch, I think.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, definitely.
Bit of sort of almost light relief from the first one.
Yeah, we say that it has a bleak ending.
Yeah.
No, definitely, I would agree with that. Yeah, without a doubt. So that's it. That's the two films on this first episode of Film and Companion Pieces. But we have got some questions, actually, from listeners. Rob Bruce, being the first, he asks a really simple question. What is your favourite film released in 2001?
Mm.
Have you got a favourite? It's Fast and Furious, isn't it?
How did you know I was going to say that? I was going to say Bring It On, but that's 2000, I think.
God.
Apparently.
Oh, God, thank God.
I don't know for sure. What about you?
Yeah, without a doubt, Donnie Darko.
Yeah.
I think it'd be quite easy to go with something like Fellowship of the Ring, because that was pretty seminal for the year, and it kind of, you know, it was great to see Tolkien come
on
the big screen.
It's a long time ago now when you look back.
Yeah, Donnie Darko I have kind of fonder memories of, because it's kind of early days of beginning to collect DVDs.
Hmm.
And I think it was my first import as well.
Yeah.
I had it on DVD a year before
it
came out.
It was a cult film, wasn't it?
Yeah. No, nobody had heard of it. And it was released in America. And then the UK waited until the following Halloween. They timed it for that. And then everyone was talking about it on the radio. And it was one of them like moments where you think, oh, God, you found this really special movie that was like literally a cult film. And it's almost like, oh, I wish I was in that position to just have a radio station and just shout about this film and just tell everybody how great it was. Because I was raving about it. It was so good.
Yeah.
Still holds up. Still love it. Have you seen it, Donnie Darko?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you like it?
Yeah, very good. Yeah,
it's a good one. It'd be a good one to discuss, actually. And there's plenty of films, I think, which you can use as a companion piece for Donnie Darko. The Butterfly Effect, immediately.
Yeah, definitely.
That would be a good one to
do. There were some good science fiction films. John Carpenter's Ghosts of Mars. Remember that one in 2001?
Awful.
Terrible.
One of his worst. But yeah, I know what you mean.
But visually, it's a John Carpenter film, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt.
You know, it's Assault on Precinct 13 in space.
Well, funny you should say that, actually. Ghosts on Mars was designed to be Escape from Mars. It was going to be the third Snake Plissken film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they kind of retooled it, and then it became Ghosts of Mars. Don't know what happened there. They probably just changed their mind with it. But are you saying which one is your favourite then from 2001? Have you actually got a definitive answer, or have you got like
a few?
Yes,
there's a few. I mean, Black Hawk Down was in 2001.
Oh, what
amazing!
Yeah.
But if we're sticking with the, I suppose we should stick with
go and listen to the film and war episodes for that.
Yeah,
but we did enough of them.
If we stick with a sort of a sci-fi, fantasy, cerebral thriller one, then I would definitely go for Vanilla Sky.
Oh, do you know what? I had a feeling when I was reminding myself of what came out that year and I saw Vanilla Sky, and I thought, I think this could potentially be one that you go for. Because, you always talk about that film, and it is brilliant.
Some of it's very subtle. There's lots of little hints in there that it's easy to miss.
Like the album covers and the details of how he mirrors stuff from his psyche.
Yeah, and there's like parallel scenes where slight things are different that you don't always notice. Like there's one scene where he's driving a Ford Mustang, and then there's another scene where he's driving a Ferrari, which looks very similar. It's the same colour, but little subtle things like that. But yeah, I definitely like Vanilla Sky. You have to think about it, and it's actually a remake of a film called
Open Your Eyes,
Abre los Ojos. Yeah. And it's one of those rare films where there's a star in both of them. So Penelope Cruz was in the original.
Comes a little bit meta because she kind of then plays a different,
and then she plays
the opposite role, doesn't
she? Yeah, a different character in Vanilla Sky. But yeah, I'd go with that one.
Good choice. Yeah, that's amazing. Now, I am curious, because in your original notes, you actually had a top three. So would that be your number one, obviously? And then you've got another, if you were to have a top three then of 2001, if you got...
Well, I was going to say Ghosts of Mars, but you belittled it, so...
It's going to be Ghosts of Mars Gate next, isn't
Ghosts
it?
Ghosts of Mars, yeah. oh, yeah, that was it. I'd chosen a documentary. I've chosen a documentary because all these are a film. So, the other film was 51st State, starring Robert Carlyle
and Samuel
L. Jackson.
I do. I remember
about
that.
They're basically coming up with this amazing new...
And that was written by a guy that worked in a supermarket, wasn't it? Yeah. And he basically got his screenplay picked up by Hollywood.
A recreational drug that they were trying to market. And then in the story, there's a hit woman who was Robert Carlyle's girlfriend in it.
Do you know what? I've only seen that once. I must have it somewhere. It's got to be.
It's worth a watch. And the documentary, which was Dogtown and Z-Boys.
Yes.
About the birth of skating. And from that, there was a movie made called Lords of Dogtown, which is a really good film.
Which I got mixed up with in the film. I remember we were talking about these films not long ago, when we were talking about Riding Giants, the surfer one. And there's a film with Matthew McConaughey in where he's something to do with surfing. And I got it mixed up, and it's somebody else that acts as the guy that helps him out. Is it Heath Ledger?
In the skateboard one, they start off in surfing, and Heath Ledger plays the... sort of mental
character.
That's
it, and that's where I was getting it mixed up.
So that's
something
surfing
else
and skating, and then there
it was
a,
born out of that, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then there is a film with Gerard Butler in called Riding Mavericks, and that's about surfing, but that's a different story.
What's that like? Any good?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, yeah. And it's a true story. It's about a young lad who's only about 17 when he went to, there's this huge break off the Atlantic coast called Mavericks, and he was the youngest person to ever ride that, and that's really good.
So is it echoing elements out of Riding Giants then? Similar characters or a particular point in time?
Riding Giants is a documentary about the birth of surfing and big wave surfing.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah, Riding Giants is brilliant. And I think it was done by the same guy who did the Dogtown and Z-Boys documentary.
It is.
Stacey Peralta.
Definitely, yeah. We should pick a couple of documentaries for a film and companion pieces episode, I think.
Yeah, and maybe films, a documentary that has then led to a film.
Yeah, yeah, well, yeah, or one of each, yeah, that's linked to it, absolutely.
Eddie Murphy.
Yes, this is from Daniel Turner. This isn't so much a question, it's a really interesting observation, but he's saying he personally never warmed to apes, but he's kind of grown to appreciate 2001. But he's saying that, yeah, apparently Eddie Murphy, massive fan of the Planet of the Apes franchise. Yeah. And when he was being interviewed on a radio station once, he made this link to, I don't know what he'd read or what he'd found out, or whether it was his own view of it, that basically Planet of the Apes mirrors The Wizard of Oz. That he's saying it's essentially a remake of The Wizard of Oz. So
it's interesting.
Dorothy, it's been kind of whisked away into this place. And
Taylor is Dorothy.
Yeah.
And then he picks up maybe one of the friendly chimpanzees is the lion. But then you almost have to go forward into Beneath the Planet of the Apes to find the magician hiding behind the curtain, which is the people, the mutants hiding behind the masks.
The
bomb.
Right, so do you think he was talking about the actual franchise as a whole? I would
say it sounds like Planet of the Apes and Beneath the Planet of the Apes. That would make sense. Maybe not the whole thing, because then that goes off into a whole direction, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe there's something about Nova as well, not having a voice, something is lost from there. Whether somebody's searching for their heart or their courage.
She's searching for a voice.
God, he's been thinking about that way too much, as Eddie Murphy. No wonder he hasn't been seen for years in his acting. Been thinking about Planet of the Apes now, how it's a remake of Wizard of Oz. Richard Hayden, he's got an interesting question. Which had the greater impact on subsequent science fiction cinema? So Yeah, he's asking which out of 2001 and Planet of the Apes. I would
say 2001. Yeah,
I think we've kind of covered that.
The way that you mentioned, yeah, the way that they do filming of ships in space and almost the sort of mundane nature of space travel. It's not all exciting like in Buck Rogers, is it?
It's
often
slow. It's real. It's
and,
real.
And yeah. Hibernation, that's the reality, isn't it? In Aliens, for example, where they're hibernating for however many... I don't know how long it takes to get there. You never find out, do you, in Aliens?
Not really, no.
Maybe it takes years to get to that planet.
Yeah, well, you kind of... You get a gist of, obviously, it can take a long time when it goes wrong or they end up floating through certain areas, like with Ripley. She's been floating for 57 years and all that time's gone by. But, you would hope that when she went away, she wasn't realising she was going to be away that long because, obviously, she had a daughter. And but that idea of... That's a dramatic element of sci-fi in itself, isn't it? That whole idea of hypersleep and you going away and sleeping.
And never coming back.
And never coming back,
that's the reality of it, isn't it?
I think one of the best stories for that, and I hope one day they adapt it, and I'm sure I've mentioned it before on either this or Mondo Movie House, is The Forever War, Joe Haddleman's counterpoint to Starship Troopers, where Heinlein's novel was a very pro-war sort of look. It's like obviously the analogy was there with Korea, World War Two, Vietnam. Haddleman actually fought in the Vietnam War, so he came out of that and he decided to create a very similar science fiction story, but was an anti-war story. Saying that, Verhoeven's adaptation of Starship Troopers, ironically, is anti-war. He kind of takes the material and he inverts it and he takes all that and almost makes a bit of a joke out of it. But Forever War, I think, would be brilliant because the notion of that film is that these troops are going off to fight the enemy on another planet. And the hypersleep part of it is a crucial part of the storytelling because they're going away. And when they return to the Earth that they've been fighting for, 500 years have passed. So they're completely disconnected from it. So it's very much about... the troops of Vietnam coming back to her home is kind of disconnected.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens is, as the story progresses and they keep going off, 500 years passes, 2,000 years passes, 3,000 years. So every time they return to Earth, it is vastly different and the human race has evolved. Now, by the end of it, and I think this would be problematic, so I don't know how they would actually do this in a modern film. It would kind of have to go through maybe... reflecting the whole thing with gender now and everything, but the spoiler alert, the punchline of Forever War is them coming back to a world where everybody on Earth is homosexual and has basically bred themselves out. So that would be incredibly dated because you'd be thinking, well, is it, you know, I don't know, do they go down a cloning angle or... Do you know what I mean? To stay alive.
Yeah.
And it's those kind of pressing matters or the things that he was trying to latch onto then, which is pretty daring, actually, to write about in the early 70s. But yeah, The Forever War, highly recommended. But pulpy. So yeah, it's not where 2001 is kind of hard sci-fi. But yeah, saying that, we say it's influential, but visually it's what they've taken from 2001 to then make into something more pulpy like Star Wars, which is very throwaway and part of popular culture. The only film really that's replicated the pace and pretty much lifted 2001 is Interstellar. There's probably others I could think about. Solaris is very similar to 2001 as well. Both versions, the original Tarkovsky one and the one with George Clooney in, I think they are more like 2001. I think Sunshine has elements of 2001.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
My
favourite
like
of all the more recent films is Interstellar, definitely. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's divisive though, isn't it? I thought it was good. I think it should have ended maybe 15 minutes early. I think there's bits in it where I think it could have literally ended with him going into the black hole. But then there's all the stuff with, like, you know, the time and space. And all really started
The links.
Yeah. Phenomenal, really. To think that it took all them years to then think, well, we're going to try and create something like 2001. But if you watched Interstellar, you think, well, 2001 really does still hold up against that. it's still a better film, without a doubt. But yeah, Christopher Nolan, I don't know, has he ever done a bad film?
No, no.
Phenomenal filmmaker. So that's it. They're the questions.
So yeah, good questions. So yeah, it was an interesting discussion. And just to put you out of your misery, I was joking earlier about the apes being hit.
That was a good story. You really strung that one out. You really aped that one, didn't you?
We've been advised by our legal team to point that out, yeah.
Yeah, we just got an email flashing up here. Thanks again for coming on. We'll definitely do another one. We'll be back again in the near future. Next episode, I've got a special guest that's coming onto the show, and we're going to be discussing the 1971 film 10 Rillington Place and David Fincher's Zodiac from 2007. Just a couple of serial killer films to cheer you up for Christmas. So yeah, looking forward to doing that. So in the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook by searching for Film using the ampersand symbol, Twitter and Instagram over at Film and Podcast, or you can head straight over to the Film and Podcast website, which is filmandpodcast.wordpress.com, where we have all the links for you to listen to us on all the other platforms. Feel free to drop us a review on iTunes, which would really help. And until next time,
goodbye.
That's just a sample of the films to come. You can't please all the people all the time, but we hope we'll please most of you most of the time. Anyway, see you soon.